Huh? No, I said Hannah decided to. Yeah, you do. Oh. You got everything.
That's good. Oh, yeah.
I was just saying Hannah decided to help you with some notes on me.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Courtney, are we recording?
I'm recording.
Great. Let's get started. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the work session for the City of Cedar Hills. Today is Tuesday, January the 6th, 2015. Currently have 6.03 p.m. I'd like to call our work session to order. The items that we're going to be discussing in work session today is presentation of the 2014-15 PI Summary Report, discussion on Harvey Boulevard traffic study by Hills Engineering. Are you from Hills Engineering?
Yes, sir.
Wonderful, thank you. And then amendments to the 2015 fiscal year budget. So we're going to have to go through this relatively quickly, about 20 minutes on PI, 15 minutes on Harvey Boulevard, and then about 10 minutes on the budget, if we can do that. So let's start then with the pressurized irrigation summary report.
Mayor, could we start with the Hills Engineering
item? Absolutely.
Jeff needed to go get a projector for his presentation.
So. Sure. Are you ready?
Yeah, I was going to project as well. But
come on up.
Well, he would like to use a projector as well.
That's fine.
So we don't have one yet.
We don't have one, so that's what Jeff went to get.
So what do you want to
start with Charles? He does not need.
Okay.
Is that okay if we start with Charles?
We can start with Charles.
Okay, let's start with Charles.
No.
Okay. Hopefully you've had a chance to look at the backup for the budget amendments. I've already reviewed them with the Budget Finance Committee, so it's all old news for them. The first item has to do with this building. Our event center rentals have done really well this year. We are, at this point of the year, we are about $50,000 ahead on our budget. And we budgeted $140,000 for the year. So the first budget adjustment would raise the revenues that would help offset some of these other costs. These costs include improving the benefits for the person over events, Natalie, and also improving the supply budget because there have been so many events, and to add supplies like outdoor chairs so they don't have to use the indoor chairs for outdoor wedding events in the spring. It's also going to be used. We had a higher animal control contract this year than was anticipated, so that went up by $750. Our summer concerts, we were going to use our own audio equipment. I think we had to rent that out, and that needed $350. And we also need $6,500 for golf equipment, which I'll go through right now. A couple months ago, I was told that there were some issues with some golf maintenance equipment cracking on one of the hydraulic tanks for the team mower, and so I came over here and I was given a tour of all the golf equipment, and they shared some of the issues they had with the different equipment. And so we discussed coming up with a 10-year plan where we could eventually replace the equipment on a regular basis and methodically so that we could budget for it and level out the expenses and not have these huge expenses be a surprise on an emergency basis. Some of the issues you have with very old equipment is it has a hard time making up the hills. If you need a part, they might not have it locally. It can take 3 weeks to get the part, so your machine can be down for a long time, which doesn't really work if you're supposed to be mowing the greens or on fairways or something. So another thing is, because some of our usually have a couple mowers, and you like to have them matching, because even if they're the same brand, sometimes they have different widths on the mowers. And if you've noticed on the golf course, there's patterns that Brian Cloud and his staff make on the golf course to make it more beautiful. And if a certain mower goes down, they can't really use a different mower for that area because it will mess up the pattern. So if you have the same matching mowers, then you can, if one goes down, you can cover it. But when you have mismatching equipment, then you can't do that. So I provided, the golf course staff took pictures of all the equipment, and they made a list of issues on each one and the age. So that's there for your reference. When they came up with their 10-year plan, they prioritized it by need, and they prioritized it by what would help the golf course, you know, the most. And so your greens mowers are always your crown jewels, so they the focus is to always have newer greens mowers. And what you're able to do with greens mowers and tee mowers is they use the same body but different blades. So it was suggested that after 4 or 5 years, you use the older greens mowers and convert them into tee mowers. Tee mowers don't have to be quite as pretty as the greens. And so we'd always have newer greens mowers. And right now, our greens mowers blades have been grinded to where there's no blade left. And they had ordered new blades, which were about $5,600. And I said, well, what if we replace your greens mowers and you convert those to tee mowers? So they would like to exchange. They can go and return those blades. They haven't used them yet. And they were going to, but they have to have something in place by the time grass grows again, and it could be February, March. So that's why we're bringing this up right now, is because they have these blades that they either have to use these new blades for the greens mower, and then they only use them for a few months, and then they want to replace the machine, or we can get the tee mower blades instead, and they can have the newer greens mowers and not waste money on having blades for just a few months. So the cost. Now we had John Deere, and we had Jacobson, and the other brand Toro all give us bids, and generally John Deere and Jacobson were the lower cost, and we had the golf staff go out and check out their equipment and test it out and kind of rank it on how they think it, thought it would perform. And we were able to get them to compete against each other. Normal government discount is 10% off the retail price. All of these bids came in over 30% off the retail price that we are recommending. So, and the way we would fund this is with our motor pool fund. In the past, use a motor pool fund for a fleet for public works and for their equipment that they use, but we haven't used it for the golf course. And so we'd use the motor pool fund to fund out the cash outlay, and then the golf course fund would pay back the motor pool fund over the life of the equipment. And that would keep the cash flow for the golf course and the expense for them. It'd smooth it out so they wouldn't have these volatile swings in costs.
So, Cheryl, I have a quick question on that. I know we did something similar in the past, but the golf fund never, because it gets a subsidy every year, it never made enough revenues to pay back loans from other funds. Are we going to get in that situation again? I mean, how are we going to make sure we have enough revenue coming in to pay back those loans?
Well, whether we, obviously we have a subsidy from the general fund. Yes, that subsidy will have to grow by the amount of whatever is needed for this equipment. So right now we're asking for $6,500 for this year, for half a year. It will be $13,000 for these three pieces of equipment for the next year.
So really it will come from the general fund?
It will come from the general fund, but you'll see a transfer. So you'll see a transfer in from the general fund to the golf fund for whatever the subsidy is. And you'll see a transfer out from the golf fund to the motor pool fund. For right now, there is one for a truck they have for $3,000 a year. It would increase to like $16,000.
Okay.
That makes sense. Any other questions? This was a solution we came up with, and we didn't want to avoid the issue and let things fall apart. So this is what we came up with, and we tried to keep the cost down. And so that was the first thing, and the event rentals here is helping with that. There's also a budget adjustment for the Utah Valley Dispatch building contribution for half of that this year. There's a one-time setup fee to switch to new financial software. And the background on that is Cassell, our current financial software provider, is doing another upgrade, and they're changing. In the past, I guess they would just ask for a one-time fee of like $20,000. And now they're just going to increase the monthly cost, and right now we pay $963, and they would raise it to $1,563 for this upgrade. So, you know, that's over $7,000 a year. So I went and looked at our options, and Polaris is another vendor based out of Orem that has 80 entities in Utah it serves. And Harriman and Santaquin are two of those, and they highly recommend, they recently switched a couple years ago, and they highly recommended Polaris. We had a couple demonstrations, and it looks like a very good product. They don't limit licenses, which means we could have as many staff access it as we'd like. And before we had to pay for extra licenses. It has much more functionality. Any of their products are included. They don't make us, every time they come up with a new product, they don't charge more. Like Cassell would charge $4,000 if we wanted to add their asset manager.
Cheryl, I don't want to hurry you, but you got about 5 minutes.
Okay. So value-wise, it seems like a good deal. So we're looking at switching in February to Polaris if that's approved, $9,000 for a one-time setup fee. And $4,500 would go from the general fund, and $4,500 would come from water and sewer fund, since approximately half of what we do is utility billing with our system.
Charles, can you check on that software whether they will export, so that I can put that information into my budget app the same
I'll
way?
Create a file for your,
yeah,
like we do right now.
Yeah.
That reminds me, I need to send that to you because it's ready. I'll let you know. I'm pretty sure they do there. They work with the state. They have the same transparency download software. They can do everything so that the state requires for compliance. We have budget adjustments for the new grants, the emergency grant. One's for a trailer. We also have budget adjustment for the forestry grants for the pruning, I think that's going on. The state's requiring us now to recognize the utilities being used by the general fund and other funds. So we have a budget adjustment to show the water that the parks use and also that the golf course use. We already have in there, Rob made a good point in the Budget Finance Committee, where we have in there the pumping costs, which is the majority of really the cost of the water, depending on the year. But this is based on the contract and Long Peak has with us is the rate that's being charged. We have budget adjustments for all the trades the golf course has done this year. So for some maintenance and some advertising. And we have an adjustment for to finish the Cottonwood work. So it would be ready for development. So that's a summary of all the adjustments. I'll just turn the time over.
There's a big one on there for meter and pump maintenance. Can you remind me what that one is?
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Yeah, so there's a lot of meter batteries going out, so they needed to speed up the meter replacement on some of these. And also, some of our wells needed some additional maintenance or some detective work, see what's going on down there. So there's budget set aside for public works to do some exploratory work on the wells. I think that's how I describe it, and some pump repairs. Okay. So, and we also have budget adjustments for the bond refunding that we did. So, anything you have questions on?
Thank you very much. We're going to have much more time to discuss this budget as part of the agenda in council meeting. Right. And so, thank you. Would you like to come up, or you're going to sit right there?
Is it okay if I sit here?
Sure.
Introduce Mr. Hills for a second.
Uh-huh.
So Ryan Hills with Hills Engineering specializes in traffic engineering, and Ryan and I go back to the late 90s at the some time at Horrocks Engineers there, and Ryan had focused specifically on traffic, and so we've asked him to look at the Harvey Boulevard 4600 West issue, and he's prepared to give you some findings and some recommendations there. Thanks.
Mayor, if I can indulge you for just a minute. Let me give you a little bit of my background, just so you know where we focus in, and I know David said it's traffic, and I really appreciate that. We primarily have done traffic my entire career, and that's what I've been doing. We actually do a lot of work for the Department of Transportation. We're working on interchange projects right now. We're evaluating traffic flows at interchanges, so they signalize intersections. We actually do the stop signs as well. We're very familiar with this. When the state does a traffic study, they have hired us as a sub-consultant to come in and help them review each of those studies. If they were to request a new traffic signal within the city of Cedar Hills, that study would come across my desk. I would review that and give the final step of approval. So we are very familiar with the state, with the requirements, and what is necessary to look at this. The reason I bring that up is that it's important that we understand that there are guidelines and practices that we use as traffic engineers. it's not as easy as just going out and throwing it at the stop sign because there's a lot of traffic. But there's more guidelines to it than that. Because we need to understand the implications of putting in traffic control. What does it mean? Typically, when you put a traffic signal in, you change the form of crashes at an intersection. The form of crashes before might be a 90-degree left turn collision where one vehicle is leaving a stop control intersection. You change it to a signal control, and all of a sudden when the light changes and starts going through the phases from green to yellow and to red, some people will gun it to try and get through. But the car in front of you may not gun it to get through. They may be stepping on their brake. So we end up with a lot more rear end type of crashes and collisions. So just that general background, the guideline, we follow the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. It's called the MUTCD. Utah has adopted their own form of that. The MUTCD is a national standard. It's produced by the Federal Highway Administration. Utah has their own version. It's very, very similar, but it has a new chapter to it, or an additional chapter, I shouldn't call it new. But it's for school crossings. Anytime you put in a school crosswalk. Anyway, that's a general background. I won't be fast as I go through the presentation. I do want to leave plenty of time for you. I'll get into one of these slides. If you have a question, feel free to stop me and ask questions as we go through it. We did this study very quickly for a very small budget. We weren't trying to focus on generating the world of data for the project, but we wanted to take a quick looking evaluation to see what was wrong with the intersection. Many of you have driven through it. We know that 4600 West has some sight distance issues. I won't belabor that, but I will tell you these are volumes on the screen of the traffic and how it enters the intersection during those peak periods. Now, we typically go out and we'll count traffic at two different times of the day. We'll count the morning condition when people are coming and leaving the intersection, and in the evening when they're going through the intersection as well. We typically find in most intersections that the evening peak hour is the highest. If you were to count, the majority of intersections in Utah would be in the evening peak hour, peak flow of traffic. We do find that around schools, it does change. Around this school, it changes as well. The peak flow is actually in the morning. There were 322 vehicles that entered the intersection during the morning peak period, compared to the evening peak period, which was 263 vehicles. So we have about a third more vehicles in that morning peak period going through the intersection. You can see how the flows actually are arriving and departing. Most of them are going east-west across Harvey Boulevard, crossing 4600. That tells me, number one, the stop signs are in the right position in the north-south direction. There does happen to be a problem that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It's a sight distance issue from the side street. The blue dot, sorry, it's not blue, the red dot on the bottom represents the stopped vehicle and the driver's eye height. In a standard vehicle, that driver eye height is 3.5 feet high. You need to be able to see another vehicle coming that's 3.5 feet high, whatever direction it's coming from. So because you're the stop vehicle on the minor approach, you need to see both to the left, so those vehicles approaching coming towards you. And on this side, the vehicles that are approaching from the right-hand side, which is the more complicated side, for those of you that are driven through the intersection. There is a boat fence that has been placed there to try and prevent that visual direction on it. This is approximately the sight distance travel that would be required for a 25-mile-per-hour speed. What it means is that the vehicle departing from the south side of 4600 West, they need to be able to depart, make a left-hand turn, round the corner, and get up to within 10 miles per hour of the vehicle that's coming behind them. So they would need to get up to 15 miles an hour. Harvey Boulevard is signed at 25 miles an hour. My speculation is, I've been out there on multiple times. I went out there the first time and I thought, you know, the speed seemed to be a little bit higher. I went back to the sight distance calcs, went back in, and checked it again. Came out to the field again and looked at it. I think people are going a little bit quicker than 25 miles an hour, as most of you would expect. They're probably going upwards of about 30 to 35 miles per hour through the intersection. Again, this is a 25-mile-an-hour sight triangle. If you were to project that backwards and come back, 30 miles an hour would be right about in here somewhere. So it's kind of coming across through this area in the higher part of the fence. I do have a couple of slides that show you what it looks like from the driver's eye height. This is just pulling up. You can see where the stop sign is located basically behind the post of the car, between the front and the back, and those little things. Stop sign is there. This is looking across the sight distance. By the time you see a car coming around the corner, it's almost too late. You almost have to be on the gas pedal, the accelerator. to make that turn that you need to make, whether it's a left or a right turn. Particularly, especially when it's a left turn, it's the most impactful. It's those cars approaching from the east headed westbound. This is looking back the opposite direction. So this is what the driver sees, and I apologize. This was taken from off the road. It was school time. Parents were coming to me. I couldn't stop my car to go on the road. I didn't think the citizens would like that. So this is off to the side, kind of looking back. Gives you the same perspective, looking back towards that stop sign. You really can't see a car that stopped there either. So there's a couple of solutions that I want to talk about. The intersection right now, when we analyze an intersection, we grade it with a letter grade like you would get in school, A through F. It's not a fair assessment because if my child brings home an F, I'm going to be a little bit upset with them. An intersection that functions at level of service D is termed acceptable by the Department of Transportation and by majority of municipalities. You don't want to try and overbuild your intersections to achieve a level of service A, otherwise you would have overbuilt intersections. You would have much more pavement that you need to maintain, wider cross sections you would be overlaying. It just would be cost prohibitive to provide level of service A, B, or even C in many cases. So level of service D is somewhat typical as a standard. The measurement on this, when we measure the intersection, it's the southbound direction where we have vehicles that are stopped more often than the northbound. And it's as if you sat there with a stopwatch and you measured how long you could be stopped there. The average delay for a vehicle in that southbound direction during that one single peak hour, because this is peak hour in the morning when students are coming into the parking lot from school. Sorry, I guess I'm right in the parents' meeting. Is 4.2 seconds per vehicle. Now again, that's average for those vehicles that are stopped in that southbound direction. There will be times where you pull up and you have to wait 10, 15, 20 seconds. There will be times where you pull up and there's no cars at all. You turn very quickly. So the average across the hour is 4.2 seconds. Intersections are measured differently if they're two-way stop, if they're four-way stop, and if they're roundabouts. On a two-way stop, you measure that highest movement or the highest delayed movement of either the northbound or the southbound traffic coming to that stop sign. As an all-way stop, you take the total delay of all approaches, measure that, and identify what your delay is. As a roundabout, again, you take the delay of all the different approaches and measure those. By comparison, if the intersection were reconfigured to be a roundabout, and I apologize, the scale is a little bit off on this, we could actually scale that circle down, that outer diameter, to make it a little bit smaller so it would not be as impactful to the outer properties and corners. We can try and keep it within as much as we can. We actually end up with a better level of service. We end up with a level of service of 2.3 seconds per vehicle. Now, the advantage of a roundabout is that as you approach the roundabout, you yield to the cars that are inside the roundabout. If there's a car coming, they're on your left-hand side. You wait till it clears, and you make a right-hand turn movement to go around the roundabout. Right-hand turns are much easier to make. It's quicker, and that's why the delay value has gone down to 2.3 seconds. Again, this is the average of all the vehicles that are entering at the same time. This is just a schematic, and I apologize that the yellow again is the wider footprint. We can work, we can try and scale that down. One way to do that is to make the inside diameter circle a little bit smaller and to make it a raised apron so that a larger vehicle that goes around can ride up on that apron and go around the roundabout. Sometimes if you're running through roundabouts, you'll see tire tracks. We don't want something cutting through the middle, and that's why typically there's something in the middle. It could be a cedar hill sign, it could be something different, whatever it might be. But something could be in that middle, in an unlimited vertical distance area, where it could be a tower, wherever you wanted it to be. But we can shrink the size of the circle down in some short. Now I want to talk about the Utah MBTCD.
Can I ask just one question while you're still on that circle?
Yeah.
Is it possible to stay within our current right-of-way without impacting the four residents that live, that own property there?
We think there may be a way to do that. It will be difficult and it will be time. So I can't guarantee you, but we'll find it out as much as we can.
All right.
And to be clear, the right-of-way actually is a foot back of walk. So there was, there's the curb and gutter section. In this case, we had combination curb gutter sidewalk. So it might be that we modify just the returns on each corner for the roundabout and stay within the right-of-way. But it would still maybe a little modification on the corners. So.
Yeah,
So I've seen some roundabouts in other cities that are quite small, usually not here in Utah. In Utah, we tend to have really big ones like the one out here. But if you look in the Bay Area, for example, you'll see some really small ones with just some landscaping and a post. Are those effective, or do you worry that people bypass them, they turn left instead of actually going around the roundabout the right way?
Yeah, I don't know which ones you're referring to in particular, but there are a form of traffic calming that we use sometimes is called a traffic circle. And so that would be a modification where you take the same four-lane cross intersection, and right in the very center you put a circle. And the idea is that cars would have to deflect to go around it. They are not as effective. I don't know if that's what you're talking about in California, but we can certainly shrink this down. What we're after is we need to get a deflection angle so the cars as they approach the roundabout, they have about a 15-degree deflection, which slows them down. Most roundabouts are traversing about 15 miles an hour, so even though the road is 25 miles an hour, people would have to slow down to go through it. That's what makes roundabouts safe. A roundabout is much safer than a standard four-lane intersection because cars are going slow and everything's a right-hand turn. So 15-mile-an-hour collisions, you typically lower the severity rate of the crashes that occur.
Right, and so early when you're talking about the sight triangle, this will improve that because now you have to turn right before you go left.
Yeah, exactly. It actually eliminates it. So you no longer have to be able to see the car coming from the left because you're going to make a right-hand turn anyway.
And what's our alternative if we want to improve the sight triangle? Just doing some landscaping and reducing the height, getting rid of the fence? I mean, what are our options there?
The alternative is you would have to more than likely purchase some of the cluttered property and go back to the way. I don't know who lives there.
It's an HOA.
Next thing you probably do is you probably have to purchase the whole corner here so that you could expand that and get a wider site triangle going through it. And you would have to drop all the landscaping down low enough that you can see around it. The fence would probably be gone, the landscaping would be gone. You could put in some local landscaping. You could have shrubs that are maybe 2 feet high, or a nice gravel cover of some kind, but you wouldn't want anything that grows high enough to improve that view. I think showing this picture might help as well. But again, cutting across and looking in that corner, your side triangle kind of comes through here. So you may have to make sure this tree is cut back. The higher fence that is back here would probably have to be dropped as well. And that landscaping would all be level.
I have a quick question on the roundabout. I don't know what the pedestrian traffic is at that intersection. We have another elementary school a little farther north, and one of the concerns that I've heard from parents recently is they're trying to convince kids to not cross at the roundabout because it's more dangerous for pedestrians to be crossing there by the way cars are looking through the roundabout. Is that an accurate assessment?
It is. It depends on how the roundabout is designed. Some roundabouts are designed in such a way that they have a splitter island that comes into the roundabout, so it splits the traffic when you enter the roundabout. Those splitter islands have been elongated in some areas where you put one car lane to the yield bar, is what I'll call it. That's the yield line. One car fits in there, and then the pedestrians cross behind that vehicle. So they walk out to the island, and then they're halfway out. They're safe. They're in the island. Okay, you got to rephrase that. They are safer because they're in the island, and they're more visible to the cars. And so cars typically will jump toward at that point. The circulating cars in the roundabout sometimes don't see them as well.
Right.
And so it can be difficult to pin up a side block. Okay. I would agree with that statement. So for the MUTCD, the only reason that I wanted to pull out the MUTCD that you want to talk about it is that in order to put in a four-way stop, which I think would be a question most likely you would ask, probably not with a two-way or four-way before going to the roundabout. In this case, a multi-way stop is typically placed in a location where you know that you're going to have a future traffic signal. So it's kind of that intermediate step before a traffic signal. I don't think this will ever warrant a traffic signal. You will never have enough traffic here in the foreseeable future that I perceive anyway. The next requirement is that you have 5 or more reported crashes in a 12-hour period that would be basically mitigated by putting in a four-way stop. So typically, the four-way stop, you'd be moving from a two-way stop to a four-way. The two-way, you'd have T-bone accidents, create a lot of high-impact crashes, high severity. I don't know, I don't think you have that here. I don't know that you have five or more 12-month privilege. If you do have conditions here, I guess the people are being cautious. They know there's sight distance issues. There's a little bit of trepidation in the crossing intersection. And then there's a minimum volume. Major street volume, you have to have more than 300 vehicles for 8 hours of delay. Right now, during that one single week period, you have more than 300, but outside of that, you don't have that at other times of the day. So it becomes a little bit.
The other concern, I think, is Harvey Boulevard's a collector road for us in our master plan, and we know that the east-west legs are the most used legs, and that was evident by your counts. What happens when more vehicles come in the east-west leg, and then they have to yield to a stop, which is the law, and our officers might be salivating here, but they come up to the sign and there's not another car ever. In that other 7 hour period, there's so few cars on the north leg route, they tend to blow through the stop sign and not pay attention to it because there are no cars. And it makes no sense that they would have to stop when there's not another vehicle there. And the east-west leg is the dominant.
And that happens
traffic.
A lot on Cedar Hills Drive at Oak Road West, which is why we do have the AF police out there periodically stopping those people from running that stop sign.
That's right. And so we could use another officer if we went that route.
Well, that actually makes it a very dangerous condition because people get conditioned to realize that there's not traffic on those north-south lanes, and they don't want to stop. It brings you to the point stop signs all over town.
Just like 3 o'clock,
right,
so
this afternoon.
I'm sure we've looked at them earlier.
It is business.
Anyway, that kind of talks about the ABTCD and the volumes and why we had moved to that four-way stop. Rather, we would prefer to look at a roundabout in that location or dropping the landscaping, some events, working on the site distance issues, which may or not be feasible. We don't know, but there are two options here.
Can I throw out one other option I don't think's ever been discussed? But is it possible to restrict so that neighborhood, there's two streets, two Ferguson's, Ferguson Way and Ferguson, that are south of Harvey Boulevard?
Yeah.
There, I don't know how many homes are in there, but I don't know, it's less than 50 probably. And is it possible that you could take that intersection and just say no left turn on it? Because there is an alternate way for all those residents to go out where there is not a line of sight just to the west and a loop road.
You absolutely could. You could put up a sign that says no left turn, but without any enforcement, you'll find people creeping out and making a left turn. And the way you got that is they'll put up a raised island to try and pursue that loop entirely. Because people on their own accord don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll think, gosh, I'm in a hurry, I'm going really fast, I need to get somewhere.
And actually, you would probably need to restrict it to a right only, because even if someone went straight across the intersection,
they still
can't see and wouldn't judge a car coming around that corner if it was going over 25.
So the reason I say that is you could take that neighborhood that's south there, and you split it in half. I guarantee you the people that are closer to the west road always go out the west road if they're going to go to the west. The people to the right always go up there. So, and it's probably only a third, two-thirds is my guess. So now you're only talking about maybe 20 houses that actually go that way.
It's funny because there's not many. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. When I pulled up to the stop sign to take that picture, I took one in the car right behind me, honked the horn. But I went down the road and turned around and came back and was taking more photos. And I was there and probably took three photos. And pretty soon there was another car behind me. And I had to leave again. So they're intermittent.
Yeah.
It's not a heavy traffic stream.
And it never will be because it ties right into that water tank. Yeah. That road will never punch through. There's no right of way there. It's impossible.
Yeah, if you were to restrict the movements, what I would suggest is a splitter island. So in that southbound direction, you'd be able to turn south.
Only, you would have to put some sort of divider out there to force it to only turn right.
So anyway, I apologize.
Mike, I guess I'm confused because I thought the issue was the people coming and traveling southbound on 46 West and then turning left.
No. It's only the people that are traveling northbound that have ever have an issue on this.
Oh, I see.
So if north were this direction, this is 24 turns.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying there. Uh-huh.
And that's what it would look like. I apologize, this is crude and fast, but you'd have a splitter island so that in the southbound direction you'd be able to make your left turn, and in the eastbound direction you'd be able to make a left turn to the north on 4600 as well.
Okay, thank you very much. And so, Mr. Hales, we appreciate you being here. We've discussed this for a little while. I think this helps the staff and council understand this a little better. How about if we bring this back to another work session soon and dedicate much more time to discuss this, because we don't have a lot of time to discuss it.
Good question. Do you have any knowledge of the costs of forming a roundabout?
You know, we haven't put anything together yet, so we haven't sized it.
Okay.
So David and I can work on that, try and bring back some real cost to you.
Thank you.
Are you turning up the volume?
Very informative.
They all need to be turned up. Everyone's is down.
That's okay.
Testing. Everybody speak like real directly into the mics when they're speaking tonight.
This one, three.
Hello.
Let's move on with the pressurized irrigation. And Jeff, you're going to have to hurry. Sorry about that.
Not a problem. I appreciate the time. As Mayor and Council, you're aware that staff has been collecting data on our irrigation system the past couple of years. And this is just a short presentation of the data that's been collected and some information relating to it. This past year, 2014, you'll see that we had a significant drop in our irrigation usage. Pardon me. In 2013, we had used 850 million gallons of water, as to this summer when we used 737 million gallons of water. And this, just a note on this, this excludes our culinary and our storm water that's added into our total. You've seen larger numbers of total irrigation usage. This is just our irrigation that we're monitoring through meters. We have accurate information about it. So we did have a drop in the usage this summer, and the total about 115 million gallons. That is equivalent to about 13% reduction of our actual metered water. This is the same as 57 tank fulls of our irrigation, 2 million gallon irrigation tank, or 125 hours of Cottonwood well, 1125 hours of Cottonwood well running. So it's a significant amount of water. This slide illustrates our week-to-week usage, and we put it on the chart. The green dotted line represents the state recommended use that we should, or our goal is to reach, and the upper line is our actual usage. It varies significantly, and most times we're quite a bit above the recommended use rate. We did have a drop in August, as we'll get into a little information on this. The reason why we feel that happened, our June usage was typical to our last year usage in the amount and the amount of time we run our pumps, similar irrigation flows, not much changed. July, we still had typical usage. In July, we maximized the production of our irrigation system. We had all the pumps running, every irrigation we could get, and we had our culinary water overflowing into our irrigation tank to try to provide enough water to meet the demands of the residents. And this happened during a month where was above average precipitation for July, well, pretty much all of the summer. August, we had a significantly lower. As you looked at that chart, you've seen it drop below the state recommended usage. August, very wet, a lot of precipitation. And September, we had an above our expected usage. Now, it was typical usage, similar to past years. However, September was extremely wet also, and so we was anticipating a lower usage similar to August. This chart represents the precipitation during this time period. This was from Salt Lake monitoring station. It's not exactly ours, but similar trends. And as we see, all the months until October was above average for June, July, and August, September, the 4 months that we was had monitoring. And the August was extremely wet in that we had just storm after storm in a close sequence. We didn't really have time to dry out. Now, the reason for our usage reduction, as we've analyzed some of this stuff, of course, is, as we discussed, our above normal precipitation. The end of July, you may remember we had a rain event. We had some minor flooding within the city. Storm lasted for approximately 10 to 12 minutes. It was quite a torrential downpour. Our tanks at that time, we was running full capacity. We couldn't fill the ponds, couldn't get the tank full. We just barely, just slowly losing ground. That storm in that 12 minutes filled our tank, filled our ponds. We estimate that one 12-minute storm gave us about 7 million gallons of water. So there's a lot of water that we collect in the within these storms. And what doesn't happen is we don't have any way to meter that water. I mean, we see our ponds fill up, we see our pumps turn off, but we don't have a meter that measures how much goes into our system. These are just estimates, but a significant amount of our reduction, we feel, came from these precipitation events. The small storms don't help us a lot, but when they're downpour, it all runs into the gutter, runs into our pond, and we collect the water. We also installed the rain delays on our major park systems. Of course, with the precipitation, this shuts them off. We had only one account that I remember this past summer where our sprinklers were running during a rainstorm, and that's because our landscaper was there working on the sprinkler system. And we did user education, which was significant. We spent a great deal of effort. This was a recommendation from our Water Conservation Committee, and we did a number of ways to contact people. We had updated newsletter articles each month. We did website articles, Facebook notifications. We did a mailer to everybody in the city, created a new web page, put signs out with updated information on our weekly usage. We had town hall meeting. We made the evening news. And we, of course, had our citizen committee, which was a great assistance and had a lot of good recommendations. I apologize for that slide. During our discussions with the committee, we had decided that we should get some information on our actual individual usage. And so we had 8 meters that we installed on various residents. And this is the information that we gathered from it. And you'll be getting this information more clearly. There was 8 of them. We just used identifiers for each one of them. But some of the information that we did get from this is that Lot A appeared to have a conscientious reduction in the usage. In June, I mean, we dropped almost in half to July, then August, September. And it was a very good example of what potential we have with all of our residents if we really get after conserving our water. The lots B through G, they was averaging between 200 and 300% with the exception of August. Now these are percents of the state recommended usages where we was our goal was to get to. And this was okay. I mean, everybody on the meters had been asked to use the water as they had in the past, so we could kind of get a baseline of
which
what we
was
doing.
Which was the irrigation system there? Or sorry, the meter put in. Was it put in June?
Yes, we started the 1st of June reading the meters. Yes. Lot H, we experienced meter failure and the data was of no value to us, so it's been eliminated. As I said, Lot A illustrated the possible reductions that we feel that we could get. This was compared to our culinary water usage reports, and the culinary water usage was typical, and we didn't get any complaints about landscape dying, so we feel that it is possible that everybody could have a reduction in water usage and still maintain a normal landscape. These are some of the events that took place during the year on our irrigation system. Quickly, we added a couple of valves, worked on some ponds. Significant changes was in August where we lost 3 pumps. And in September, we lost another one. These were on pond 10 and 12. 2 of them were actual motor failures. One of them was the electrical control panel failure. And then we did clean our irrigation tank this year. The city staff did that without contracting it out. It worked very well. So in summary, this year, we had improvements to the system, and the system improvements provided better service to some localized areas of the city. On the lower zone, upper end, people was not getting enough water pressure in the past. This kind of alleviated that problem, and they now have pressure. The improvements to our sprinkler system, we feel, did reduce our water consumption as a city. And we know that our residential usage is pretty accurate at 2 to 3 times more than the state recommended. And our water usage again in July was, we maximized our system. It was greater than our irrigation system can produce. And we did have increased equipment failure. We feel it's due to the longevity. I mean, the equipment's getting older. It's run a number of years without any failures. It's not really unexpected. So our recommendations from staff is that we continue in our process to initiate the Water Conservation Committee recommendation to install service lateral meters. We do feel that this would help our system and our community in a positive way. We suggest maybe we retain the services of a professional public education group to expand on what we did last summer, maybe educate citizens more. And we'd like to see a promotion of the positive community benefits that we could have by metering our pressurized irrigation. That's the presentation. If there's any questions.
Do we get to know who that A was?
No, these are secret.
Thank you, Jeff.
You twist my arm really hard. No.
Is it, David, can we get this presentation emailed to all the council members?
We're going to add this to the monthly management report. Jeff's department will put that in the report.
Great.
He'll have some additional information with it.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a 5-minute break, but I want to say a couple of things before we do about the agenda tonight. So I want to thank Mr. Crawley for a discussion you started about sledding up at Tim Cove. And so we kind of just started a discussion online, so I think we can handle this administratively, but we do need some recommendations from our insurance company and probably from staff. So unless council wants to create an ordinance that mandates we do or do not something regarding bales or other technique, I think we can handle this administratively. Is everyone okay with just continuing a discussion by email? All right,
yep.
Good. Then there's been much discussion about council assignments, and so I was handed an interlocal regarding Lone Peak Public Safety just before the meeting began.
And so I would like to table our action item on assignments until we get a legal opinion in terms of what this means, because it kind of puts everything in flux. So if everyone's okay with that, then we'll put it off until we know exactly what that means. Okay? Let's take a five-minute break.